Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. We just passed the official start of summer, and it's likely to be an eventful one for investors. Already shaping up to be the case, we did witness over the weekend the U.S. launched airstrikes on Iran's nuclear facilities. In addition to that, policy developments on tariffs and taxes, the potential impact of tariffs on the economy and corporate earnings will keep investors preoccupied. So, joining us today to discuss this all, glad to welcome back in studio Jason Dreho, Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. Jason, even though it's starting to feel like summer outside, we're not exactly getting that summer slowdown in the markets, right?
Well, good morning. Happy Monday. And you're right. It's the start of summer. And of course, it goes into the upper 90s in New York City, where it's kind of also humid. Thankfully, the office or the studio is nicely cool to keep the equipment comfortable.
Definitely.
So yeah, lots of things. It's not going to be quite summer. I think it's something where, unlike other years, it feels like there's a whole litany of things that investors have to at least monitor.
And with that, Jason, perhaps let's begin with the top story at the moment. And we are continuing to track this very closely, starting with the U.S. military action against Iran that took place over the weekend. What is the Chief Investment Office, Jason, tracking to monitor the situation? And what do you expect from here?
Well, certainly at the moment, we know like the U.S. launched, you know, military strikes targeting Iran's key nuclear facilities. I think what's still being assessed is, you know, how much damage was done, you know, what, and then also, like, you know, where do we go from here? The two key things that, you know, kind of we're going to be monitoring as, you know, the focus shifts to how Iran, you know, retaliates and whether energy supplies from the region are disrupted. I think the two key questions that we have are, you know, will these energy exports from the Middle East overall, not just Iran, you know, be interrupted, but also through the Strait of Hormuz? And then also, will other major countries, you know, intervene? So on the first topic of sort of retaliatory actions by Iran, it's a clear risk, right? They could attack U.S. bases in the region. They could attack U.S. allies. They could try to damage energy infrastructure to cause oil prices, you know, to go higher, which would be negative for certainly for the U.S. economy, at least more, you know, directionally negative, and certainly for the global economy overall. You know, they could do this also by, you know, threatening, you know, maritime traffic through the Strait of Hormuz. That's a possibility. Now, having said that, it's also kind of, you know, I think relatively clear that Iran's military capabilities have been, you know, significantly damaged by the air campaign, not just by U.S. actions, mm-hmm. but also by Israel over the course of the past now about 10 days. Iran's military and navy likely won't be able to resist a combined sort of U.S. and Iran forces for that long. So they could retaliate, but there's limits to what they can do. In terms of other countries getting involved, you know, Russia is, you know, one, or even China, but both have a relatively muted response. You know, Russia would certainly, you know, maybe stand to benefit if the price of oil went higher as a major oil, you know, producer. It would help fund, you know, their own government and, you know, maybe give them a economically stronger hand as they continue to, you know, perpetuate the war in Ukraine. However, ultimately, we don't think this is kind of in Russia's, you know, interest to want to get involved. They have their own sort of, you know, obviously, you know, issues with Ukraine. They need to stretch it further. They don't necessarily want to perhaps give the U.S. reasons to then, and President Trump to, you know, up the stakes by imposing stricter, you know, sanctions or other, you know, actions supporting Ukraine. So all that suggests those two issues, disruptions to oil, other countries getting involved, certainly risks, but we think those would not be part of our kind of our base case. You know, the main conduit ultimately from any action in the Middle East, it comes down to oil and like the supply and therefore the price of oil. That's how it impacts the global economy. That's how it's going to impact broader financial markets. It's interesting that this morning the price of oil went up $4 kind of overnight, and then actually now as of we speak, it's basically flat. Mm-hmm. Now it did rally quite a bit leading up to this in anticipation,
right?
Or at least, you know, the moment Israel, you know, launched attacks, then the thought was, well, there's a risk premium that we need to build into the market, including the possibility of extra U.S. airstrikes. In order for oil prices to go really kind of sustainably higher, you know, a couple of things probably have to happen. One is that there needs to be actual physical damage to the region's energy infrastructure. That would ultimately kind of push oil, you know, say towards $100 a barrel. Like there has to literally be physically mm-hmm. some sort of constrained supply. Another factor is there could be an internal power struggle, you know, in Iran that would lead to sort of supply disruptions, you know, similar to what happened back in the Iranian Revolution in 1979 or the Libya during the Arab Spring of 2011. So again, you know, new possibilities, but that's what would really kind of have to happen. Thus far as just the market's response would suggest, like, if oil keeps flowing, and there's no real sort of damage to supplies, then oil kind of stays where it is. It's pricing in, a reasonable escalation from here, but not outright supply damages. So that's why I think you're seeing overall the markets sort of take it somewhat in stride.
And Jason, despite unknowns with respect to how this might all develop from here, as you mentioned, market pricing as we're recording on Monday morning around 9:15 Eastern, fairly muted. In fact, U.S. equity futures have turned now slightly positive, leading up to the market open in about 15 minutes. How do you interpret this reaction?
Well, yeah, so oil was rose and now it's flat. The S&P futures lower, but then now they're basically flat as we're recording. Treasury yields are down a little bit, but not significant, like a few basis points across the curve. So a little bit of flight to safety, but not entirely, because if you look at traditional safe haven currencies like the Japanese yen or the Swiss franc, the yen is actually a little bit lower. The Swiss franc also kind of against the dollar a little bit lower. The dollar overall is up a little bit, sort of indicative, at least for the moment, of sort of the safe haven status. But if you looked at this price action, didn't know what happened over the course of the weekend, you'd think, all right, it's a Monday morning, early summer, people have gone away for vacation, we're not seeing a lot of activity. And that's kind of interesting. But it was sort of consistent with, you could say the muted response by Iran so far, sort of, and whether there will be a significant response or not, that time will tell. But that's what the markets are perhaps saying, is that a measured response or something that would be telegraphed by Iran in some way is signaling that, we don't want this to escalate, perhaps we don't want to negotiate. So it's at least consistent with that. That could prove to be, of course, the wrong assumption. The muted market response, I think, is also consistent with the view that Iran doesn't want oil supplies to be disruptive because it actually needs the money, given other problems domestically they have going on with, it's been a difficult economic environment for Iran for a number of years. So they may not want to have that goal, escalate. So you could have skirmishes and fighting and missiles launched back and forth. But in terms of the global economy, this may not, ultimately kind of matter that much. And we've seen this, in the past, which is, the market response being muted is consistent with the market's response being muted to past escalations and tensions in the Middle East. Even if we go back to, October 7th, almost 2 years ago, markets sold off, and then, within weeks, we're already kind of rallying to all-time new highs, even though there's a risk of escalation back then. And so ultimately, it sort of comes back to, putting a probability on what happens in the Mideast at this point in time, what happens with Iran's response is very difficult. What we can try and do is calibrate, well, if they do respond, what are the consequences for the U.S. and global economy? And unless there is a real disruption of oil, and there's not a strong incentive for that to happen, then the impact is relatively modest. So it is, logical. The market response is logical. It's still sort of surprising when you think of what happened over the course of the week, and you think this could be, triggering another broader regional war. So the markets is kind of shrugging off. It is noteworthy at this point in time, but not sort of unexpected given the facts we have on the ground.
So, Jason, this segues into the market setup at the start of the summer with so many factors for investors to closely monitor. I'm curious, is there a ranking order, so to speak? Is there anything in particular that you feel investors should watch out for most closely?
Well, we continue to obviously monitor the situation in the Middle East and how that plays out, along with other geopolitical consequences. This is going to have knock-on effects for what's going on in Ukraine and sort of, how that sort of evolves over time. Same thing with geopolitical matters with China and sort of, issues there. Putting that aside, I wouldn't say there's a rank order of things, but just maybe, in the top of my mind, which perhaps is implicitly a sign of my order of importance, is thinking about sort of just the economy overall, because ultimately sort of comes down to what is the fundamental picture. And then anything that happens, you can sort of contextualize it in the context of, does this make the economic outlook look better or worse for whatever reason? So in terms of the economy, I think the markets where investors are really focused is, what are the consequences of tariffs that have already been put in place, continue to be put in, increased and stay in place? The expectation is that, from a sequencing perspective, that the real kind of consequence for inflation probably won't become apparent until the July data that comes out roughly in mid-August, with sort of the peak level of month-over-month increases of inflation some point in the fourth quarter before it starts to kind of moderate. Year-over-year effects can continue to rise well into next year. After that, you look for a slowdown in economic activity. Growth would slow, consumption would slow, the labor market could slow. That would come after the inflation increase. And then the logic behind that is you need a negative kind of real income shock because inflation goes higher due to the tariffs. That hit to real income means people consume less. That slows the economy. That means job growth kind of slows. So there's a sequencing, of that. So that's kind of what is, what I'd be monitoring there, how that data actually plays out. Because thus far, it's not really evident yet in the data, certainly not the inflation data of a real impact. On domestic policy, certainly, you know, the situation with tariffs and how that plays out. But we are now just under 2 weeks away, or maybe exactly 2 weeks away from the 90-day reprieve on the reciprocal tariffs that was announced back on April 9th. That would expire by July 8th. And so, you know, what happens then? It's only one sort of deal, kind of in quotes, you know, framework between the U.S. and the U.K.
Right.
So not a lot of time to get sort of, you know, progress there.
A lot of hope at the G7 that we'd hear more on that
front. And of course, that it became sort of a, once President Trump left, then that became sort of a secondary or at least kind of definitely a back burner issue at the moment. There's the question about the One Big Beautiful Bill as it works its way through Congress. It should be coming out of Senate committee this week. There is certainly momentum that it could be passed potentially by July 4th, or at least it looks like it's all still on track to be able to, you know, pass at some point in July. But that is, you know, something to kind of worth watching. And then as we get into July, mid-July, that's when second quarter earnings season starts. Mm-hmm. So again, looking sort of for further guidance of like how are tariffs impacting companies. In Q1, they hadn't really been put in place yet. Now by Q2, it has been sort of disruptive. Do we see impact on revenue, margins, sales, and projections from companies going forward?
So a lot coming down the pike that could move markets. Sticking with markets for a few more moments, just given the market's response to the U.S.-Iran news over this past weekend, I'm curious, Jason, what do you think would actually move the markets more significantly, or do they keep grinding higher from here?
Well, if we look at the price action this Monday morning, despite the rationale that I gave for why it's not surprising that the markets have been sort of shrugging their shoulders, but it is consistent with, you know, if this can't sort of stop the markets, you know, from moving higher, cause a significant pullback, you know, what would? If we also look at the price action just last week, which is kind of a holiday shortened week with Thursday being a holiday, so definitely lighter trading activity on Wednesday and Friday, so take it with kind of a grain of salt. But for the week, the S&P 500 was down 0.15%. But the Russell 2000 Small Cap Index was up 0.4%. And for the month of June, the small cap index is up 2% roughly, and the S&P is up 1%. And this is despite rising geopolitical risks, higher oil prices that are up 20% during the course of the month. These things should be weighing on cyclical assets, and yet small caps have been doing better. So it is suggesting, even if the S&P hasn't sort of broken out to all-time new highs, there is this broadening of risk and sort of people willing to take almost more risk, you know, kind of small caps are emblematic of that, consistent with the market sort of grinding a little bit higher. You know, will this continue or not? You know, this is in a very technical basis. It's hard to make these predictions, but it does feel at the moment like the path of least resistance is for the markets to keep running higher until some kind of material risk event happens. So really the question then is what would cause the markets to have kind of a real hiccup? So if we go to kind of the growth data that I mentioned, it's widely expected that because of tariffs that inflation will go higher and growth will slow. So if we see data move in that direction, and it's not really surprising. This is sort of what we anticipate. It's like the pilot coming on the plane saying, we're going to hit some turbulence coming up. So when the bumps hit, you're not completely caught off guard. The question is whether that turbulence is mild or actually causes a real problem or not. And so I think, you know, a mild turbulence is okay. But if we think of inflation and the sequence that I mentioned, if investors sort of become somewhat complacent because the inflation data has been relatively contained thus far, even surprising to the downside for the May data, that, you know, they get complacent, then all of a sudden we get the July or August data and it's 0.5 or 0.6 month over month, largely due to tariffs. Suddenly this might be like kind of jolt investors. Like this is, we're actually seeing this. We're now in the eye of the storm. Likewise for growth, the sequencing I lay out would suggest you're not going to see growth really roll over until towards the end of summer or the fourth quarter. But if we get a situation during the summer where consumer spending drops quickly, or we get a payrolls number that is say sub 50,000, you know, well below where it's been sort of holding steady in the 125,000 kind of range, that will spook investors. We saw that last summer where it was a July labor market report that came out in early August that was around 11,000. Subsequently kind of revised higher, but it definitely spooked markets and investors about how our growth is kind of rolling over. So as much as you can prepare for it, it's off like, you know, the analysis or this Mike Tyson expression that everyone has a plan until they get, you know, hit in the face.
Right.
So I think it's going to take more than just some modest slowdown in the economy or higher inflation to really kind of, you know, cause the markets to pull back. And that's definitely kind of a risk that happens. If we turn to other policy matters, like everyone now, I think investors who are in the market have become complacent, perhaps on tariffs as a risk because, and for justifiable reasons, because we've seen multiple times now just in the past few months where higher tariffs are announced and then a short period of time later, they're delayed, they're lowered, they're reversed. So anything that is you know, a deal's not done. It's like, okay, fine, they'll extend the deadline. Or they go higher, that's fine. But then 2 weeks later, there'll be some reprieve. So at some point, you just sort of kind of ignore it. It also seems like it's in the administration is sort of zeroing in on a range where they would like to keep a 10% universal tariff in place, maybe some sectoral tariffs. So the effective tariff rate may not be that much different than where it is now. The allocation could differ, but it'd be surprising, or it would take a lot, I think, for the markets to suddenly move a lot on tariff news at this point in time, which, again, not saying it won't, but I think the bar is high to be negatively surprised. For the budget deal, the one big beautiful bill, like, this is something that if it doesn't pass, I think the markets would view, at least near term, okay, fine, though, they will extend existing tax cuts. But the market rally we've seen in the past couple of months has not really been predicated as on this OBBB being a key catalyst, thinking we'll get more fiscal stimulus. Anything not having that bill passed in the current form that doesn't increase the deficit, that actually might be welcomed by investors in terms of bringing kind of rates down.
Sure.
So again, that's probably not a major kind of market moving event. So really, it's almost things that are harder to predict or not fully on the top of, you know, investors' kind of radar screens. It can reflect some investor positioning. If you recall last summer, there was a situation where the yen carry trade was very prevalent. And then the Japanese, you know, the Bank of Japan sort of kind of surprised the markets by saying, well, raise rates, you know, more quickly than anticipated. That caused a significant unwind. And just that deleveraging caused massive churn in global financial markets. At the same time, there was a massive churn within U.S. equities, you know, when investors pivoting away from just being long sort of tech stocks. And then for at least a brief period of time, going into small caps, this massive rotation. So July had a huge churn. A lot of that was also driven more by technicals more than it was huge fundamental changes. So against things like that could also play out. And there are certainly some consensus trades, whether it is, you know, short dollar, you know, long gold, long, I think, Bank 7 again is sort of a consensus trade at this point in time. So things like that could amplify, kind of moves where something that seems relatively minor could actually trigger things that sort of cascade to be a bigger, you know, pullback. It's just harder to sort of identify when a catalyst like that could materialize.
So with those considerations, Jason, in mind, you shared with us CIO's market outlook. What should investors be doing right now with respect to portfolio positioning?
Well, you know, I kind of laid out a case where the markets could grind higher. And sort of the more they do and the more that they become indifferent to some of these risks, the more vulnerable they are to some sort of data point not materializing, because then position will get further stretch and you get, you know, unwinds like we saw last year in the summer and, you know, in April this year in terms of the, you know, the tariff news. So there is certainly some vulnerability. And things ultimately, the economic data is likely to get worse before it does at some point kind of get better later on. So I think you need to kind of be prepared for that. But I think this what it does tell you, that there's some sort of, you know, market resiliency, that any sort of pullbacks of, you know, 5% or more will probably be relatively quickly bought. So our message of phase into equities, you know, be prepared to deploy that capital if you want to invest in it, because, you know, the pullbacks could be relatively shallow for the time being and of short duration. So you have to have, you know, kind of be ready in that regards. Within it, you know, U.S. equities look, you know, relatively well positioned to do that, in large that part because an area where there's still, you know, fairly strong consensus is, you know, on the Mag 7 and into the tech sector. That remains one of our more attractive sectors. And it has certainly been kind of outperforming. The AI theme that got dinged earlier this year after the DeepSeek news, that's been a key driver, and there's definitely a positive momentum around that. And so that's something we can continue to kind of like at this point in time. You know, thinking about, you know, on the fixed income side, a lot of uncertainty, you know, yields kind of chopping around. So again, just not taking a lot of interest rate risk because yields could go higher. Also not taking a lot of credit risk because you don't need to take a lot of risk to get decent income right now. And then gold, you know, continues to perform as this kind of portfolio kind of diversifier at this point in time. So those are a few of the key things. You know, in some way, I've said this on recent calls, but I think, you know, they were valid before. And as we see the price action the last week, I think they're consistent with that kind of, you know, thesis holding in place.
Well, Jason, thank you for reinforcing CIO's current guidance when it comes to portfolio positioning. A lot of factors to be mindful of, a lot to keep us busy in the weeks and next couple of months ahead. So do look forward to picking back up with our conversation next Monday. In the meantime, stay cool and thank you for dropping by on this Monday morning.
Thank you. Have a great week.
You as well. Thank you, Jason. Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.